You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Tuesday, February 16th, 2021, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
How is everyone this lovely week?
Warm and toasty.
Yeah, pretty good, man. We have
warm
power
here in LA.
Electrons
are
flowing.
Freezing our butts off.
Yeah,
power's on.
We have a pretty. We have some serious snow on the ground. It's unfortunate. It's at that point where there's an ice dam around my driveway, so I have like 2 inches of water flooding the lower part of my driveway. But it's middle of February. That's pretty predictable for middle of February. But it's supposed to get up to like 50 tomorrow, like crazy warm.
Whoa, really?
Yep. We'll have some melting.
Yeah, the high today here was 72, I think. That's Fahrenheit, by the way.
Kara.
Not Celsius.
At least we're not in Texas.
Yes, that's why
Truth.
We're talking
well,
about
Texas
it.
Is one of the warmest states in the Union, Steve.
Not today or yesterday or the
right
day before.
Now, or at least as of this article I'm reading, the Dallas, Texas is colder than Anchorage, Alaska.
Yeah, my family lives in Texas. I was born and raised in Plano, Texas, which is a suburb of Dallas. My dad lives in Plano, my mom in Richardson. My sister is in a small town called Stephenville, and she texted me yesterday with a screenshot that showed it was 1 degree.
Yeah.
Wow.
And the thing is that we have to remember is that there is no infrastructure for this in Dallas. None. Mm-hmm. This is not typical at all.
Well, to see how bad it was, we decided to talk to our friend who happens to live in Texas and get news from on the ground. So we actually have on the line with us Stephen Blackwell. Steve, how you doing, buddy?
It's been an adventure.
So right now you're talking to us from a bathroom in your grandmother's house? Is that what it did?
Well, my mother-in-law's house.
But even worse.
No. I was thinking it. Didn't say it though.
I kind of got lucky in that regard. She's pretty cool.
Good for you.
Cool.
But we've got 9 people piled into a 2-bedroom house because my brother-in-law's family and my family are without power, without heat, and have been for pretty much since 9 o'clock yesterday morning.
Oh no! Mm-hmm.
On top of that, it was the Dallas temperatures you guys just mentioned. It was single digits.
Mm-hmm.
And we hardly got any snow. I have friends out in Austin, and they've got 5 or 6 inches with now more ice storms coming tomorrow and Thursday.
Oh, my God.
Wow. So they're really screwed because when you've got 5, 6, 7 inches of snow and there's no plows, there's no sanding, there's no salting, they can't go anywhere. And we all are suffering with whatever you hear about the rolling blackout, that's a myth. Yeah. It's just a blackout. There's no rolling to it. I can deal with a rolling blackout because you can plan.
Well, I think the idea is that the rolling blackouts are there to try and prevent the total blackout that you're now dealing with, just the straight up loss of power.
We have one friend who Jennifer works with who they, in their area, which is up by Dallas now, they have the rolling blackouts.
Yeah.
And they can kind of plan around it. But most of the rest of the state is just without power.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the thing about Texas, if you guys aren't hip to this, the Texas grid, they are not connected to the rest of the continental U.S.
Mm-hmm. I read that. I know that.
Now, they privatized it, and it's old. They've had several times before where freezes have done this. Not as bad, but done it. That were warning shots, and they ignored them. And every time they do this, and this isn't the only time they've done this kind of stuff, but every single time they do it, the only people it hurts is the people.
Here's
one for you. Have you guys seen that meme flying around that shows the helicopter using fossil fuels to lubricate the the windmills, blah blah blah? And it's not a picture from here. It's a picture from Sweden from like 4 years ago.
Oh, that happens often.
Yeah.
So, Steve, are you saying that right now the windmills are what's giving the little power that Texas has is coming from windmills?
There's still some nuclear plants and there's still some gas and stuff, but it's woefully diminished capacity.
Yeah, the problem is everybody's, you know, pumping things at capacity. And the I know my mom said she got an email from the city that said, you know, the guidance is unplug everything you're not using and turn your heat down to 68. You can live at 68 on your heat. Do that to relieve some of the pressure on the grid. But I don't know if everybody's doing that. A lot of people have old space heaters that they're trying to make use of where they can't control the amount of power that they use. And, you know, lives are in danger right now. It's not safe.
And again, you're talking about a place with no infrastructure for dealing with ice on a sidewalk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the ice is almost more dangerous than the snow, isn't it? That's why Texas shuts down even at a light freeze, because there's no way to get rid of the ice, and it's so dangerous to drive and walk.
And these people don't, they all think they're the best drivers ever.
You're so right.
Oh my God.
I remember that about Texas. I thought it too, man.
They're literally the worst drivers.
We were so mean about the Okies that would come down into Texas, like, oh, Oklahomans, they can't drive. And we're going like 20 over on the freeway.
So I'm looking at some news items here. Firefighters helplessly watch home burn as power outage cuts off water.
Oh, God.
17 deaths already.
Yeah.
Tied to the winter storm. Oh, man.
And also, wasn't there just a few days ago, so it was like at the beginning of all of this madness, like a horrible like 40 car pileup or something on the freeway?
Worse. 120. 120.
Oh, my gosh.
121.
121 car pileup. No, I mean, I remember that growing up that this awful. Would happen a lot. But 120 is big.
Yeah.
And the problem was, too, it was early. It was like the... timed for like 6 in the morning, 7 in the morning. So it was mostly, or not mostly, but there was a significant percentage of hospital and emergency service personnel because that's shift change.
Steve, I'll tell you what, you've had a hard time. When this is over, I'll send you some meatballs.
You got it, or some lasagna, whatever you got.
The weather map is amazing. You can see the blue reaching down all the way from like the Arctic down to right down to Texas, all the way to the Gulf.
And we're not supposed to really, I mean, we're supposed to be above freezing, I think, tomorrow, but at night it's still going to be below. Thankfully, most of the roads melted off today. So they're actually very, you know, pretty drivable, except they still have the highways closed.
Well, Steve, stay safe. I hope you get warm. I hope you get your power back.
All right, brother, be safe. Keep us updated. You know, text us when you can and let us know what's going on.
Will do. Thanks, guys.
See you, Stevie.
Bye-bye. Bye,
Steve. Bye-bye.
Yeah, that's our friend Stevie. He used to live in Connecticut, and then for some reason, he decided to move to Texas.
I know exactly why he did.
All right, well, let's move on to some news items. Let me start by asking you guys a question. So you know that there were mammoths walking around 14, 15,000 years ago in North America.
No, like 3 to 5,000 years ago.
Not in North America.
No, but they were walking around elsewhere.
Well, I said in North America.
Yes.
We're talking about North America. So what do you think killed off the megafauna? Not just the mammoths, but, you know, there were giant beavers. There were American cheetahs.
Camels?
Lack of there food. Was, no?
Horses.
This is an ongoing debate, right? Was
it's an
it,
ongoing debate, but what would you say? Where
was
do you
it human intervention, or was it an ice age, or was it a it's, climate
wasn't
change?
Wasn't it weather?
It's complicated.
I think it's climate change and people.
Yeah, so there's two main hypotheses. One is the overkill hypothesis, that humans arrived in North America and killed off all the megafauna through direct hunting. The other is that it was climate change. This was the transition from the glacial period to the interglacial period. We've spoken about before about the Younger Dryas. You guys remember that one?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so you had the ending of the glacial period from the Paleocene to the Holocene around, you know, 14,000 years ago, where it warmed up considerably. But then from 12,900 for about 1,300 years, there was a cold snap, like a really vicious return of not only really cold temperature, but very dry. And that's really when a lot of the megafauna died.
Is that why they call it dry ass?
No, so yeah, it's dry ass is from the flowers that were common in the fossil record. You know, so that just it determines that layer, you know, in the soil. But yeah, the question is, was that enough to kill off the megafauna? So there was... 38 genera went extinct during that period of time, mostly mammals. And, you know, mostly the big ones, giant tree sloths, glyptodonts. Have you guys ever seen a glyptodont?
No, what is that?
Aren't they like rhinoceros looking?
No, like they look like giant armadillo.
Oh, yeah. Oh, those are so cool.
Yeah.
Steve, can they roll up into a ball and like crush you as they roll by?
I don't know that they're armored. I don't think they roll up into a ball, but they...
It's like a big carapace. They might be able to tuck into it, but...
More like a turtle.
Yeah.
So... This is one of those scientific debates that I love because there's a lot, the scientists are really having to dig deep in terms of like, how do we even answer this question? You know, there are different schools of thought that are exploring different lines of evidence, and there's no definitive answer right now. And there's a lot of sub questions within the bigger question of like, what killed off the megafauna? We talked previously about what caused the Younger Dryas. That's one also controversy. Was it a comet impact in Canada, or was it the melting of the glaciers and the runoff of all the fresh water altering the jet stream and then resulting in the plummeting temperatures? And that controversy is raging in the background as well. So what is the evidence? Interestingly, there isn't any direct evidence of humans hunting megafauna in North America.
Isn't
that interesting?
Wait.
Yeah.
Wouldn't there be like marks on the bone from tools and stuff that would be identifiable?
So there's a site in Mexico that is a trap, meaning that it's a collection of mammoth bones, and it appears that they fell into like a crevice. The question is, was that engineered by people? Like, did people herd them into the trap?
Oh.
Or did that just happen every now and then?
Yeah, it was a fluke.
Yeah, just every once in a while, a mammoth would fall into the crevasse.
Is there any evidence? Is it a Sarlacc pit?
It's not a Sarlacc pit.
Damn.
But there's humans definitely messed around with the bones. Like, for example, like there's out of seven mammoths, every right scapula is missing.
Weird.
Yeah. There was definitely some work on the bones. But that doesn't mean they killed them. You know, they could have just scavenged them or done rituals on them. They didn't necessarily be responsible for killing them.
But do we know that they had weapons then?
They did. They did have a toolkit. They had, you know, if you recall, we Arrowhead. Talked about this. You know, yeah, they had the different toolkits in North America.
Yeah, we talked about a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. But a few years ago, paleontologists found the first direct evidence of humans actually hunting mammoths. It was a flint tip, like a spear tip, in a mammoth bone.
There you go.
That's pretty good.
Unless that's that mammoth fell over on the spear.
Oh, that's right. Landed on it.
So that, however, was in Poland. So we have evidence of Europeans hunting mammoths, not the Paleo Indians that were in the North America at the time.
Steve, we do have evidence at the same time that they were hunting other animals that do have, say, weapon tips lodged
not,
in them.
Not megafauna, though.
Not megafauna.
Yeah.
But something more easier to kill.
Maybe mesofauna.
Part of the reason for this is that there's just a scarcity of fossil evidence, right? We just don't have a ton of fossils. And so you could always say, well, you know, that doesn't mean it wasn't happening. You know, at some point we'll find the smoking gun, right? The spear point in a mammoth skull, you know, whatever. We'll find direct evidence of hunting. But until we find that, you could argue that we don't know if they were actually doing it. And so, but there's also a statistical argument you can make, and this is the actual news item. Because we don't have a lot of, you know, a lot of direct evidence, and there's a lot of inference going on here in terms of what likely happened. You know, paleontologists are trying to make statistical interpretations, saying, well, based upon the evidence that we do have, what's more likely? And like, for example, you say, well, if they were hunting them to extinction, not just occasionally picking off a mammoth, but if they were engaged in a massive enterprise of hunting megafauna to extinction, then we would be seeing tons of evidence of that. And so the lack of evidence is all the more telling because of the hypothesis, not just they hunted them, but that they hunted them to extinction. But another approach is correlational. It's to say, if the overkill hypothesis is true, then the extinctions of the North American megafauna should correlate with the arrival and the spread of humans. And if it was caused by the climate, it should correlate with significant climate change, specifically that younger Dryas, like the significant drop in temperature.
Sounds reasonable.
A few years ago, scientists published just such a statistical analysis, and they concluded that it's the overkill hypothesis. Case closed. This 50-year controversy has been finally and forever resolved in favor of our side. We win. It's
okay.
The overkill.
Declare victory.
Yeah. Wait.
Plant your flag.
When did they do this?
A few years ago.
Why didn't they do this earlier than that? Like, we've known about these different geological.
Well, so what they were doing was looking at carbon dating and then analyzing the correlation between the carbon dating, the amount of carbon dated material over time of both humans and the megafauna. Now the new study says, whoa, not so fast.
Of course.
They did a new type of statistical analysis, which they say better corrects for the error, the uncertainty in the carbon dating. Because they said that the problem with the older method is that the uncertainty can lead to false patterns, that if you look for a pattern, you're going to see it. So we need to fix that. And what they did was they did a simulation of known evidence to say, like, they took a known fossil record and said, all right, so we know that A correlates with B over here. So let's do our statistical analysis and see if it retrodicts the known data. And if it does, then that validates their model,
sure.
Right?
Right.
So then they said, yes, our model actually works better than the older model. And then when we apply our new statistical model to this question of the North American megafauna, it shows that their extinction correlates with
weather.
Climate change. So it's the exact opposite of what the other team came up with, which I think throws us back into uncertainty, in my opinion.
And also, wouldn't it not be the case that with the change in climate also comes the change in eating habits?
Yes, that's
also
something
comes the change in migration
exactly.
patterns.
Exactly, I agree with that too.
And also comes the change in food scarcity. Yeah, I mean.
So it could be that the humans were hunting the megafauna because it was cold.
Yeah.
Because, you know,
exactly.
There's not a lot of food around, but there's that giant mammoth over there. Why don't we kill that thing, you know?
And we need more fuel to fight the
cold. We can cut
them
open and we can get inside and get warm.
Well, yeah. And also, yeah, we need to make skins. I don't know when these certain types of innovations were. What year range were you saying we were looking at?
13,000 years ago to 11,000 years ago.
So we don't even have evidence of pottery in the U.S. or in North America, I don't think.
Well, can't we just find like the newspapers from the time?
Pop.
Oh, yeah, they would have been all decayed. I get it.
So, yeah, I'm not even sure like how much tool use or I don't know. There was. Were people wearing skins? Animal skins?
Yeah, probably. I mean, I think
that probably goes back
a lot longer than that. And we have evidence of hut making, like putting wood in the ground and making a hut like for a million years. You know, that goes way back.
Yeah, but I think that pottery only goes back like 10,000, maybe less than 10,000.
Yeah, thousands of years. Yeah, but not definitely not that long.
Yeah, so we wouldn't even ever have that animal because there have been those cool studies where they found milk in pottery.
It depends if you're talking about all over the world or specifically in North America. But
yeah, North America.
For the world, the oldest known ceramic artifact is dated as early as 28,000 years.
That's amazing. Yeah, and
was that Israel?
But that was in
China?
The Czech Republic.
Republic.
Not in North America.
Yeah, North America, I think it's like just under 10,000
like,
years.
Yeah, 5,000. Like 5,000.
Is that the Clovis, early Clovis?
So the Clovis people is another big controversy. You know, the Clovis people had
Clavin.
Definitely. They had a toolkit that was designed to kill megafauna. You know, it was bigger.
Right.
And then that was replaced by a finer, weapons that were clearly geared towards smaller animals. So that's one piece of evidence. But again, we've never found human remains next to Clovis tools.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So yeah, we're just lacking, all these separate pieces, but we don't have the evidence to stitch them all together.
Yes, so, we call that circumstantial evidence in forensics. Yeah,
exactly. There's a lot of inferential evidence. There's a lot of circumstantial evidence, which is why you can have different schools of thought. But I do love the fact that they're arguing about, well, how, what kind of evidence can we find? Can there be? How would this address the issue? What are all the different lines of evidence we could bring to bear? And they're making their case, and they're just going back and forth with evidence. It's awesome. So that's, to me, that's more fascinating than the answer itself. I, you know, whatever the answer turns out to be, that's fine. You know,
it was, and I doubt the answer is either or anyway.
Yeah, as we were saying. Agree.
It's probably both.
That was my guess.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the change in climate. So here's another very interesting question. So, like, for example, the pro-overkill hypothesis scientists are like, isn't it an awful coincidence, you know, that they went extinct when humans were extended throughout the North America? And you could look at other parts of the world and that generally extinctions flow in the wake of human migration. Mm-hmm. And it's not just from direct hunting. It's also because humans bring rats, you know, and rats are good at killing eggs and things in their nests, you know, and they could bring disease. Also, they could change the ecosystem in other ways other than through direct hunting.
Yeah, it's, they also eat the plants that certain animals eat, and then those animals don't have them to eat. And
hey, we know that, I mean, I don't know how far back this goes, but we know that, like, the Native Americans in California, what is now California, were burning the forest in order to grow acorn oaks, you know, they were burning all the other kinds of trees. They were dramatically changing the ecosystem, even though they weren't hunting. It was an acorn culture, but they were burning down forests. It was, you know, so-called cultural burning. But in any case, yeah, so humans can have a profound effect on the ecosystem through hunting and through other means. We do tend to sort of devastate ecosystems where we go because we, you know, of our population density, because we bring other animals with us, like rats, for example.
And we exploit resources. Really,
we exploit resources,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
And we hunt, and we absolutely hunt. But also, you know, it certainly is plausible that the transition from the glacial to the interglacial period was definitely a stressor, a climatic stressor as well. So some scientists have asked, well, were there mass extinctions during other glacial, interglacial transitions? And that's a good question, one we do not have a good answer to, but there isn't evidence that we could conclude one way or the other. So we just, that's another line of investigation that somebody could pursue at some point. Right? So is it plausible, you know, that there would be a mass extinction just because of this transition? Has it happened before? You know, the last time was 125,000 years ago. We can go back then. So in any case, this is something that's going to take another 50 years, I think, you know, of different lines of evidence, you know, being brought to bear. And I do think I agree with you, Kara. I think that the answer is going to be, yeah, to all of it. You know, there was multiple stressors. Yes, there was hunting. Yes, the weather was a stressor. Yes, there were other ecosystem things going on that were adding stressors. You know, that was definitely an extinction event. You know, that was a pulse of extinctions. And it really was like the megafauna mammals. You know, it wasn't a specific type, you know, part of the ecosystem disproportionately. It was above, you know, background levels of extinction. So it definitely needs an explanation.
So I have a quick evolutionary question for you.
Yeah.
And of course, I know that this is going to be way more nuanced and way more complicated, but by and large, let's just say, like, gross back of the envelope calculations, wouldn't large megafauna be less likely to adapt to massive climate shifts than smaller animals? Just if we were to look at all other variables being equal, the bigger the animal, the less likely it is to be able to change its mechanisms for survival.
I don't know that. So the broader question is, you know, so some animals are more adaptable; they're generalists than others, and specialists go extinct much more quickly than generalists.
Panda.
And so the question, I'll reframe your question to be, are megafauna necessarily specialists because they're so large?
Right.
And I don't know the answer to that question off the top of my head. What I do know is that the reason why the megafauna is so mega, right, they get big because it's so cold, right? Because you want to have less surface area per volume. So bigger animals are adapted to the cold. But interestingly, when in the interglacial period, in that initial warming, their populations increased. So they do fine when it warms up. There's just more food around, you know. But then when you know, the continent went dry and cold, that's when their populations crashed.
Well, we also see island gigantism, which has nothing to do with coldness. It's just once something is like isolated from other things, it just tends to get big.
Yeah, but what happens is
I thought the opposite happened.
It's both.
What
happens is the smallest animals get big and the biggest animals get small. So you have dwarf elephants and giant rats.
That sounds horrible.
I'm not visiting that island.
Okay, so who would win in a fight, you guys? A dwarf elephant or a giant rat?
They talked about
the rat.
But think about this, guys. They talked about, remember, the Hobbit, you know, the Homo floresiensis. So they were a diminutive human species, maybe whatever, they were like 4 feet tall. But on that island with them were giant rats. So they were living with rats that were comparative to them, the size of large dogs. Yes.
Ew.
Oh my God, can you
imagine? That might be kind of cute. Like a capybara.
Yeah, but, you know, a rat.
I mean, you know, it's still a rat.
All right. I know people who've had rats as pets. They can't be cute.
Yeah, they can.
Yeah.
Let's move on. Bob, tell us about the fifth dimension. Sounds like a science fiction show.
Oh, that was a music group from the 50s.
Bob's not talking about the music group from the 50s.
No.
Oh.
No.
Well, then what is he talking about?
Listen, friends. Researchers claim new insight into dark matter this past week. They say their model may point to the true nature of dark matter, and it requires a brand new particle and, wait for it, a fifth spatial dimension.
What?
And that really caught my attention. So this is from theoretical physicist of the Prisma Plus Cluster of Excellence at Johannes Gutenberg University, Mainz. Their recent publication is in the current issue of the European Physical Journal C. I'm pretty sure the C in Journal C stands for cool, or it could be crazy. One of those two. So if it's true, I mean, this would be a trifecta of science awesomeness. You'd have, on one hand, you'd have a potential solution to some of the biggest mysteries, specifically dark matter. You'd also throw in new physics, brand new physics outside of the standard model, and potentially this could be testable. I mean, those three together, that's like multiple Nobel Prizes, I think. If this pans out, this is, you know, pretty early, so let's not get a little crazy, but let's talk about it. Now, we've all heard of extra dimensions in science fiction, right? But in the late 90s, it was taken more seriously, perhaps than ever before, when they realized that if we could associate or extend our standard model of physics, the physics that we've been using to explain and predict all the particles and all the forces, if we could extend that into a fifth dimensional space-time, then a lot of big mysteries in particle physics would be resolved. And that reminds me of cosmic inflation, right? Because cosmic inflation was this idea of the exponential inflation after the Big Bang. And that one idea solved a plethora of physics problems, like the flatness problem, the horizon problem. Look them up. So this kind of reminded me of that. It reminded me of that. If this is all true, then it's a good analogy. But if not, then it won't be. So we shall see. So just a few years ago, more progress was made on this theory than when the researchers' five-dimensional field equations that they developed predicted a brand new particle. It just popped out of the math, and it was similar to the Higgs boson, but much heavier. You guys, I'm sure you all remember the Higgs, the so-called God particle, that a lot of people hated that term. I regret saying it now. But the Higgs field gives mass to all the other particles, right? It's the Higgs field is the way to say it. This was the last particle predicted by the standard model, and it was finally seen at the LHC in 2012, and it won a Nobel Prize the next day. I mean, just like, bam, here you go, Nobel Prize. Definitely deserved it. So now this new particle would have a tremendous mass, much greater than the Higgs, and the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider, could not produce this. And nothing on the drawing boards can either, which is very disappointing and frustrating because, like, damn, you know, you got this great new theory and you want to be able to prove it. You got to make it testable, right? That's what science is supposed to be. So this was a few years ago. Now this most recent paper adds a new juicy layer to this science onion. They discovered that the particle that they predicted would necessarily be able to mediate a new force between elementary particles in our universe with the ones that exist in this extra dimension. So this particle would be kind of like a go-between between our universe and the particles in it.
and these potential particles in this extra dimension that are somehow connected to dark matter. So that's what got them all excited. Now, it's really hard to describe exactly, you know, what is going on with this force and the mediation between the particles. So I'm just going to use the scientists' words themselves to describe this. They said, if this heavy particle exists, it would necessarily connect the visible matter that we know and that we've studied in detail with the constituents of the dark matter, assuming that dark matter is composed out of fundamental fermions, which live in the extra dimension. Okay, so they're talking about fermions. Now, fermions, you may have heard of them. They're common everyday particles. They're electrons, quarks, protons, neutrons, et cetera, et cetera. So they're the particles that you kind of would come up against in your everyday life. They're not these super exotic particles that require accelerators to produce. Well, now, one theory over the years, there's been lots of theories to explain dark matter. One of those theories is that dark matter is called fermionic dark matter, so that dark matter has some basis in fermions some way. So that's related to what we're talking about here. So here's another quote. Fermions could be communicated into the fifth dimension through portals, which is a very unfortunate word that they just used, through portals, creating dark matter relics and fermionic dark matter within the fifth dimension. Now, I wish they didn't use fifth dimension and portals, because now people are saying they discovered a portal to the fifth dimension. No, they did not discover a portal into the fifth dimension. Please tell that to all your friends.
Can't go there.
There's a couple other quotes. They say dark matter could be the result of fermions pushed into a warped fifth dimension. Let's see, one more. Fermions jammed through a portal, there's that portal again, to a warped fifth dimension could be acting as dark matter. So that's how they describe what this new particle is doing in mediating the forces between our particles and these dark matter particles in this fifth dimension. I'm hoping that in the near future they'll be able to have a better way to describe this. And maybe there is no real easy way to describe it except only in mathematics, because I mean that's how some of this stuff is. Look at quantum mechanics. Now, likely not much would come of this. You know, if this was just yet another one of the higher dimensional theories that could never be experimentally verified, that happens a lot. But this is the real good bit here. Matthias Neubert, who's the head of the research team, said this: "We are now confident that the mechanism we have discovered would make the dark matter accessible to forthcoming experiments, because the properties of the new interaction between ordinary matter and dark matter, which is mediated by our proposed particle, can be calculated accurately within our theory." So that's promising. And also, they say, in the end, so our hope, the new particle may be discovered first through its interactions with the dark sector. So they're saying that we may be able to potentially discover this new particle because of the way it interacts with what they call it, with this dark sector that they refer to this realm as. And then if we need another angle, some of the researchers are saying that they mentioned gravitational waves, and that somehow gravitationals might be produced, especially in the far distant past, when these dark matter particles were created, and that they can be searched for with future gravitational wave detectors. That's promising. And we all know about gravitational wave detectors and their potential. And so that's very encouraging that in the future, I'm not sure how sensitive they would need to be, because they're already pretty damn sensitive. But once we get some of these gravitational wave detectors in space and have them separated by vast distances, they will be even more sensitive. And so maybe within a generation or so, they'll be able to use these to detect, this evidence of this particle and the force, and potentially even, this higher dimension. So down back to Earth, this is a new theory. You know, what this theory is trying to do is, think of it this way. It's trying to understand matter that's never been seen by using a particle that no one has ever detected, and also by invoking a frickin' fifth spatial dimension. So, all right, so just calm down, everybody. This is still some crazy stuff. On the other hand, this isn't just sci-fi fan fiction or the result of cranks, but I'll leave this to the particle physics community, see what they have to say. And lastly, I'll say that, I looked at their five-dimensional warped geometry theory, and it's fascinating. It's fascinating, and this stuff is true. I mean, they invoke things like cosmological brains, BRANES. If you haven't heard of that, brains is essentially a construct. In this case, it's a construct that our entire universe would exist on, with all the forces and particles, except for gravity, which may be tied to another brain, and that would explain why gravity is so weak. And then all of these brains, imagine if there's multiple brains, it could be one, there could be two, but these brains would exist within this warped higher dimensional space. So this is the theory, this is the model that they're working with. And if this is true, I mean, this would be, you know, one of the biggest discoveries. I mean, you're discovering not only new physics, but a new dimension, a new particle, a new force of nature. I mean, just an amazing suite of discoveries. So I hope that this is real, but we'll see. Hopefully, maybe we'll get evidence, maybe you know, other physicists won't knock it down, you know, immediately. I don't know, but we'll see. I'll be keeping an eye on this one because it is pretty interesting stuff.
Yeah, but you know, it is definitely the kind of thing that you need to follow over time to see if it has any legs.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, now it's just spitballing, it sounds like.
Yeah. So yeah, absolutely. And what I described is, you know, I tried to, you know, I've read a lot of commentary about their paper. I went through their paper, which is damn dense. Oh my God. And it helps. It helps. But I really wish I knew more particle physics to really, you know, take apart their paper. But that's what other physicists are for, and what I'm for in some sense, and trying to make it understandable.
All right. Thanks, Bob. All right, Kara, tell us about the bird's magnetic world.
So we've often known that songbirds have like an amazing sense of direction. They're capable of navigating over thousands of miles. They do it every year, you know, going from Europe to Africa and back, and they go to the exact same place that they went the very first time. And it's been kind of a long and complicated question, similar to the questions that you were asking us earlier during your news item, Steve, about like, why is it? What's the mechanism? What do we know? What contributes to it? So there are these, you know, differing hypotheses. Some of them have a little bit more weight than others. But it does seem to be the case that, you know, there are a lot of different things that are involved in animal migration, and specifically with migratory birds, we see things like olfaction being really necessary, scents and smells. We especially see this with seabirds, with homing pigeons. We think that there are visual cues that are really, really important. But of course, a big part of the research that gets that we go back to over and over is about the Earth's magnetic field. How do birds utilize the Earth's magnetic field? We're still not completely sure. There's some research pointing to things like utilizing these molecules called cryptochromes that are sensitive to light. Some people think that there might actually be sensory cells that have magnetic particles in them, like iron oxide particles, but they've never been found. So even though we don't yet know the mechanism, researchers are getting better and better at uncovering what is going on with birds when they migrate. And there's a new study that came out in Current Biology. It was just published on February 12th. And they did some really cool, interesting experimentation to come to some interesting findings. But before we dive into that, there's a couple words we need to know. I think that probably you guys know these words, but maybe not. We've heard of declination and inclination from like an astrophysics, or not even an astrophysics, but an astronomy, like a stargazing perspective, right? But have you guys heard of magnetic declination and magnetic inclination?
I've heard of it, yeah.
Okay, So declination, which is really important for this story, is the angle between magnetic north and true north, because we know that those are not in the same place, right? We've talked about that a lot. So the difference between magnetic north and true north is the declination. So when magnetic north is east of true north, the declination is positive, and vice versa when it's west. Inclination, which is a little bit less important for this story, but still important to know, is the angle that's made by a compass needle when the compass is held vertically. So inclination has to do with how magnetic fields point downward into the earth at the point of the measurement. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
When we think of magnetic fields, they go pole to pole. So they're like north-south generally. There's no right-left magnetic field. So we measure right-left by declination. That's the difference, again, between true north and magnetic north. When we are looking at north-south, we're calculating it both by the magnetic field, but also by the magnetic inclination, which is the angle that it gets pulled in towards the earth. That's a part of the north-south calculation. Okay, that kind of makes sense, right? So it turns out birds probably have their kind of own GPSs. And how do they have this? Because it seems pretty likely that they're actually using a grid, their own grid, in a similar way that GPSs calculate these different measurements in order to to navigate a grid. Birds seem to be doing something similar. Again, we don't fully understand how, but this is how we kind of know. There have been a ton of experiments, navigation experiments, where birds are thrown off course during a migratory event and are able to course correct and find their way home anyway. It's very common for birds to get blown off course, and for whatever reason, they're able to find their way back. But these researchers did this really, really cool, interesting thing. They use this weird box, and they put the bird in the box.
What's
and
in the out- box? Oh, bird.
Put the bird. Yeah, just a bird. just a songbird. And outside the box, they were able to, and this is like a really special box that is often used in these types of experiments, but outside the box, they're able to induce magnetic fields. And what they first did was an experiment to, let's say, in a non-real world setting, change the declination, similar to an experiment they had previously done where they changed a bird's declination in a real world setting. So just like I said, the wind blows, a bird is set off course east or west, and it eventually course corrects to find its way back. And the researchers were like, well, that's cool. They can somehow accommodate declination changes. So they were like, let's test this experimentally. We'll put them in this box. We'll induce this magnetic field. And in inducing the magnetic field, we'll take them where they are, but we'll make them think that they are east or west of where they are.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And then they look at the direction the bird flies when they open the box. Mm-hmm. Or the direction it tries to fly. Because the bird with his little birdie feet makes little scritchy scratches on the floor of the box. And they can tell by the little launch scritchy scratches which direction the bird is trying to fly.
What? Really?
They can?
Yeah. Wait, yeah, it's really cool.
Wow.
Yeah, because it's on its migration path. So they know the direction of its path. They're catching them. Mm-hmm. And they're putting them in the box right where they're caught. So the birds are exactly where they are within their migration path, and then they induce a magnetic field to make the bird think that it's either east or west of where it is.
Right.
And what they found when they did this is that the birds couldn't really correct themselves. And they were like, well, crap, that doesn't really comport with the research that shows that the birds could course correct. So then they had another idea. What if we change everything, not just the declination, but also the north-south coordinates, and we choose a coordinate on the map that's outside of their migratory pattern? So it's a place a bird has never been, but it reflects accurately a real geologic place on the globe.
Oh,
so they did that, and the bird was able to course correct.
Oh, yeah. My God.
So what they think is that, and this is still hypothesis, but it's hypothesis in action, that the bird couldn't course correct the first time because it wasn't a real place, and because the bird could recognize that there was an interference pattern, that it didn't represent actual geography, that they were able to ignore that cue. Because there are little blips sometimes when birds are flying. There are little, you know, magnetic blips. And if they were constantly reacting to them, they might not be able to fly accurately. But since they induced a magnetic field that approximated a real place on the globe, even though the bird had never been there, even though the bird should have no reason to know what that place is like, it knew how to correct in order to get back on track, which is freaking awesome.
Yeah, that is now, like, just unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. Like, they can't say for sure that that's exactly what the bird is doing. You know, there are obviously, whenever you do a study, you talk about the limitations of the study. You talk about, you know, what some of the different reasons could be for why they course corrected or why they didn't. But their, you know, outcome, their hypothesis seems to be in line with a lot of other research, but it's pushing it further. You know, this is not a new area of research, but this specific twist on the research is new, and it seems to be, you know, just like chipping away even closer at what's going on with birds. This Cartesian coordinate mechanism, you know, is theoretical still, but there are, you know, a couple of different hypotheses. One is that they have like a pure capability to navigate a magnetic grid, and the other is that they follow more of a rule of thumb. Like, generally speaking, they know that they're, let's say, northwest of where they should be, so they course correct until they find other cues that help them realize they're back on their migratory path. So that could be sensory cues. That could be other cognitive cues, right? Visual cues, seeing other birds that are migrating, maybe smelling the right smells that tells them they're back in the migratory corridor. Or it could be purely magnetic. We don't really know that yet, but either way, it does show that they have a sense of how to course correct and get back into their migratory corridor. And that sense is purely based on the magnetic field lines of the Earth. And of course, the experimental change to them within the little bird box. I don't know. It's fascinating. I love this story.
Yeah, what's cool to think about with things like that, like I also think about this with echolocation. Mm-hmm. It's not that they're hearing the noise and consciously interpreting it. It's subconsciously being, you know, constructed the same way our visual experience is subconsciously constructed and then just presented to our conscious experience.
Yeah, we don't have to be like, that is closer, that is farther. I shall walk longer to get to the thing that is farther.
We just know it. We just sense it. And it's just a sense to us. It's the same thing. They're just sensing the magnetic field, and their brain is processing that information, and they're just reacting to it.
They're like, I'm going the wrong way. Yeah. Got to go the other way.
So it sounds amazing, but it's like, but they're just seeing magnetic fields, you know?
And it's partially the reason it's so amazing, I think, to us is because we don't have it.
Yeah, of course.
And that's always, it's really cool to envision a sense that we don't have. It's like a weird exercise in empathy because it's like, we talk a lot about those biohackers, like that movement of people who want to kind of induce changes to their bodies in order to experience different phenomena. And you might talk about biohackers who implant magnets under their skin and see what it feels like to be drawn to something that's magnetic or whatever. And it's not the same, right? Because we don't have certain capabilities and other capabilities we might have latent in our brain, but evolutionarily they're like vestigial. But and other ones we just don't have that kind of architecture. But it's really cool to think about experiencing something like seeing infrared, for example, and we have tools to let us do some of that. Like we can look through certain filters and lenses, but to be able to just live in that world where you have these senses that aren't the senses that human beings are used to, it's a like cool thought experiment.
Yeah, that's cool. All right, Evan, tell me about this story. This story sounds like total bullshit. It's the Pentagon has UFO wreckage, but they're talking about it as if it's like an alien spacecraft.
Well, I think you kind of hit the nail on the head there, Steve. Boy, Roswell, right? Boy, this gets the classic skeptical juices flowing, that's for sure. I got to give you a little bit of history for context. Bear with me. We're aware of the origin of the term flying saucer. The thing that sparked the greatest cultural contaminations of the modern age. So I have to give you a little brief primer on this. It is relevant. All right. June 24, 1947, amateur pilot Kenneth Arnold, he's flying to an air show in Oregon when he saw a bright blue flash of light in the sky near Mount Rainier. And then he saw 9 more flashes of light in quick succession. He could not figure out what he'd seen. Upon landing, he told people at the airport what he'd seen, and word spread quickly. The next day, he was being interviewed by a reporter. He tried to describe the motion of the objects to the reporter as like a saucer if you skip it across the water. Those were his exact words. Well, the reporter took this to mean that the objects themselves were saucer-like, not about their movement. And there you go. Flying saucers is born. And what that did is it went in an age where there was no viral, as we know it today, it went viral. The analog viral era, in a way. Because by July 4th, there were newspapers, literally hundreds of them, reporting on flying saucers and people's accounts all over the place. It was such a hot, hot topic at the time in a very short amount of time. And on July 4th in New Mexico that same year, that's when the rancher found the remains, the material remains of something that fell out of the sky. Couple days later, he takes it to the local sheriff of Roswell, New Mexico. The sheriff calls the officials at Roswell Army Airfield. And the next day, an intelligence officer for the armed services issues a statement to reporters saying they were in possession of the debris of a flying saucer. And he actually used that term. Oh boy, did that set off a storm that we're still paying for today, in my opinion. Next day, cooler heads prevailed higher up in the chain of command, and the Air Force retracted that claim. They said they actually captured the remains of a weather balloon. We know many, 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 many years later, it was Project Mogul, which was a top secret air surveillance program in which we were trying to detect the actions of the Soviet Union and their nuclear tests by sending up sound sensing material equipment into the high atmosphere.
Yeah, they were corner reflectors.
Yeah, that's basically right. So there you have it. And so the news item this week is that, I mean, there were so many headlines about this. United States Defense Intelligence Agency, the DIA, released 154 pages of partially redacted test results about the about material science. Right, Bob? We love material science.
Oh, yeah.
The declassified documents contains five sections, metallic glasses, biomaterials, materials for advanced aerospace platforms, metallic spintronics, and metamaterials for advanced aerospace applications. Okay, so what's the big deal? Why was this report released? Well, thanks go to a person named Anthony Bregaglia, who is a lifelong UFO enthusiast. He lives in Florida. He submitted the Freedom of Information Act request back in 2017 that got the wheel spinning on this particular release. And it all links back to, well, his impetus for doing it was about the debris found back in Roswell, July 4, 1947. He is under the assumption that this report and these pages of this report are alluding to materials that were collected at the Roswell crash. How he is able to actually make that bridge based on the report itself is quite remarkable. Because if you read the report, and the report is on there, it's available on the internet, it has nothing to do with the remains or items retrieved from crash sites at all. They're just talking about the technologies themselves.
Yeah, Evan, he writes, talk about, this is motivated reasoning in action, right? He says, oh, you have to quote unquote read between the lines.
Of course.
Which means you have to make shit up out of whole cloth according to whatever you want to believe. That's what that means.
And because he spent the years putting through the effort, the FOIA requests, the initial rejections, and having to rewrite it and resubmit it, and they finally do release something many years later, he has to be able to claim victory in some capacity. He can't just say, oh, they released a bunch of pages on a bunch of material science reports that have nothing to do with anything having to do with extraterrestrials or crash sites or anything. If you read it, it's just straightforward material science reports, which are cool in their own right, but they have absolutely nothing to do with what he's bridging it to. So that's what he's trying to pin this to. And of course, the headlines, you know, they're always going to go, you know, say anything Roswell, say anything UFO. And it's an instant headline in at least, you know, some circulations and some papers and places around the world, frankly. And it did pick up some traction around the world. One of the things that he talks about is their extensive, he remarks about how often they bring up nitinol, N-I-T-I-N-O-L, nickel titanium. Bob, you familiar with that one?
Yes.
Yeah. Shape altering materials. Or in other words, if you, it's a material in which you have
dependent.
It. Yeah. And you can crush it and turn it into something else and it'll apply a little heat and it'll reassume its original shape. breakthrough technology.
That's cool.
Yeah. However, this particular science has been around for nearly 100 years now, in which people have been experimenting with these kinds of alloys and materials that will do exactly that. They predate the Roswell era. And what he's claiming is that the tinfoil material that we know about as part of the wreckage of the Roswell balloon and Project Mogul. There's all sorts of stories about this being this very smart super technology that only aliens at the time, for some reason, could have come up with, responsible for everything having to do with their technology at the time. And there's no way, apparently, that people or even the U.S. government and their secret projects could have been possibly using at the time. That's not true. That's not true at all. And I'm not even convinced that there were these materials that he's claiming were found there. It's almost taken, he takes it for granted, or he makes the grand assumption that these metamaterials were found there as part. And it's not even a discussion as to if. It definitely was. It was part of it. And the reason why? Well, because 40 people said so. 40 different people have 40 different stories about this material in which some people handled it and other people saw it. And they said it acted in strange ways and you would crush it up and it would go back into its original shape like nothing they'd ever seen before. But they're all stories and they're all very weak stories. After all, you know, they're talking about there was a boy there, and he maybe this the son of the rancher who found it. Well, he picked up a piece of the material and pocketed it and held on to it for a long time, and then eventually later gave it up to researchers who then determined what its properties were. And then another person also was out there, and he found it and he buried it in a box out in the desert, so that, because it was, you know, so unique, and he didn't want to be. He knew he had something special there, but didn't want to get caught. So he buried it for 10, 12, 15 years, and they went out, dug it back up, and then got it into the hands of scientists who determined what it was. Funny how it all came about actually around the time that these materials were being written about, were being discovered, were being used in the 1950s, in the late 1950s. And suddenly, a lot of people have their memories jogged, Oh, yeah, I remember that material. I saw that at Roswell. Oh, that was part of the crash. So there's your 40 stories with about that level of weak, not even evidence.
Yeah, the chain of evidence was broken.
Yeah, entirely broken. And we know all about the fallibility of memories. We don't have to harp on that because we talk about it so often in so many topics that we do talk about. And you're getting people from the 1960s, 70s, and 80s to talk about what they were experiencing, what they read, what they were doing at the time back in 1947. I think you're going to have some contamination here and there among their stories.
Yeah, the narrative takes over. It's all about the narrative now. There's no actual evidence.
Absolutely. But he said, okay, the author, and I'll wrap up with this. He said, based on the documentation received, this is Regalia, he said, it appears the recovered debris exhibits the extraordinary capabilities by remembering their own shape when bent or crushed. Some of these futuristic materials have the potential to make things invisible or compress electromagnetic energy and even to slow the speed of light. So, yeah, it's kind of...
And you know what else slows the speed of light? Pretty much everything.
Yeah, right. Know? Exactly.
When light passes through stuff, it goes slower than its maximal speed, which is in a vacuum. So water slows the speed of light. Glass will slow. That's how lenses work. You know, they slow the speed of light. The material that returns to its shape, you mean like rubber? Like,
yeah.
What are you saying, Steve?
It kind of slows it. It doesn't really, really slow it, but it kind of slows it because it's still going, you know, its usual speed, but it just takes longer because it's going a more circuitous path. But yes, you can say that it slows it. It goes more slowly in other mediums or media, but technically it doesn't. Bob, just throwing that out there.
Bob, he said that these technologies represent a literal quantum leap beyond the properties of all existing material known to man. So, you know, hyperbole much there. And, you know, obviously when you invest your life in a narrative, in a story, and you go through a lot of effort and you're pouring everything you have into it, you cannot break yourself from that. You cannot suddenly unmoor yourself from that. You are invested to the maximum, come what may. And whatever the results and breakthroughs that you supposedly have, you're going to claim victory no matter what the result is.
All right. Thanks, Evan.
Yep.
Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
Okay, guys, last week I played this noisy. Any guesses, guys?
I heard like an ice kind of sound in there somewhere. Is there...
I thought it sounded like cooking.
Carrie, you're cooking on the brain tonight.
I know. I'm like, Steve, you're better at this than I am.
All right. Well, this one was definitely difficult. Got a lot of guesses. Visto Tutti wrote in. He says, I hear water slapping on a boat, then an aircraft low pass. You have me stumped beyond that. And not a horrible guess. Let's keep going. We have a listener named Jordan Mueller. Hey, Jay. At the first listen, my gut was saying creaky ice splashes, some kind of vibrating vehicle passing with a Doppler shift. Has to be something passing someone on a lake in the spring when the ice starts melting. WTF. But a couple more listens, and it is a total facepalm as my brain decides to remind me I have heard this sound before. The creaks of ice turn into cables under tension, and the vibrations turn into the sound of rollers. This has to be a chairlift or gondola. Brother, I give you an A++ for effort.
A++.
And you will facepalm yourself when you find out what it is. So I'm going to jump right to the winner. We have a winner from last week. And the winner is Oliver Bayer. And he says, hey, Jay, thanks for your great noisies, which I always enjoy. And thanks for featuring me the other day. I guess he guessed a previous Who's That Noisy. For this week's noisy, I am at a loss of what it could be. I think I can clearly hear the Doppler effect of something coming towards you, passing, and then driving away. And since it sounds like the sound is recorded in water, I'm going to say it is a high-speed boat that is passing by another boat on water.
And he nailed it?
That is correct. However, there are more details. So this is an AC-75 class of boat. They are unique to the America's Cup, as far as I'm reading here. They're 75 feet long, they weigh 7 tons, and they're entirely powered by the wind. They can reach over 60 miles per hour. And the key thing here is they actually travel on hydrofoils built by carbon fiber. 60 miles per hour is absolutely incredibly fast on water. So the person who sent this in said that it is basically like, you know, like a Formula One car on the water. You know, that's how fast these things are. So let me play it for you again. So it's kind of like, think of like a regatta type of boat, but incredibly more futuristic and just beautiful looking. So when these things get to speed, they're barely, there's like a fin in the water. That's it. They're touching the water in a couple of places because they're riding on you know, the foils. So they're really cool. Check out the sound again. And that was it, just zipping past the boat where it was being recorded. Very, very cool. I do highly recommend you check out the video. You can look up an AC-75 class boat, and you'll get to hear that yourself. So I have a new noisy for this week, and this noisy was sent in by two listeners, actually. Jir Kusuman Manon, sorry, man, you know, come on, and Oyvind W. Olsen. Okay, they both sent in the same exact noisy. Basically 5 minutes from each other, and they both seem like cool guys, so I wanted to use them both. Here it is. Of course, my attraction to this sound is quite obvious. Now, let's test Kara. How well does Kara know me after all these years? Kara, why do I like that particular? Yes, of course.
Yes. Because
it clearly has blaster-like sounds. This one is more complicated than you think. There's multiple things happening, and I'd like you to give me the best description that you can. Email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org, and don't forget, if you heard something cool, send that to me too.
All right. Thanks, Jay. Jay, we have a couple of announcements that we should talk about.
You are correct.
You have Nexus coming up August 6th and 7th. That's Friday and Saturday, August 6th and 7th. Nexus, this is mainly a save the date. You can check necss.org as details develop. And we are tentatively rescheduling for the second time our Denver extravaganza. This one is going to be on Thursday, November 18th in Denver. Where can they go to find information on that, Jay?
You can go to theskepticsguide.org/events, and you will see the Denver extravaganza and the Denver private show happening on two different nights, one on the 18th and one on the 19th.
Couple of emails. The first one is a follow-up to the lie detection segment, Jay, that you did last week.
Yep.
This comes from Fred in Canada. And Fred writes, big fan of the show. Thanks for that. I'm a police officer and just wanted to make a quick comment about the lie detector news item and following discussion. In the episode, I believe that the comments reinforced a misconception about police interviews that I have seen many times. It boils down to a study demonstrated people are bad at determining and if someone is lying to them, even police. This is scary in the context of police interrogations. I hope that is a fair summary of the conversation in the episode. I think the issue with this is that it ignores the context that most police interviews occur in and the training we receive. Interviews take place normally after a large amount of evidence collection and investigation has happened. The purpose of an interview is to compare the content of the interview to the evidence at hand. While someone's emotional state is certainly something to notice, it is only a piece of what we would call a constellation of facts. I could say more on the topic and am aware that there are issues with methods some police use at times, but this message already feels pretty long. Thank you for your time, dedication to your listenership, and science skepticism. Well, thanks for that email. So actually, I wrote back to Fred. My sense is, and I do think we could have hit this point home harder, which is why I wanted to follow up. I agree completely with Fred, and I think that was the actual point we were making. I don't think that his summary was my sense of what our conversation. So what he's talking about, this is how I think I would explain it. There are two basic ways you could tell if someone is lying, right? You could do a content analysis, or you could do some kind of functional analysis. The functional analysis is like, are their eyes darting around? What's their body language? You know, do they look like they're stressed? The content analysis is, is what they're saying plausible? Are they contradicting themselves? Are they contradicting evidence that we have, etc.? The only useful method, I think, where there's actual evidence that it's effective is the content analysis, is actually doing the investigative work. I said doing the police work. You do the investigation. When you interview somebody, you already have all the information, right? We talked about this actually not too long ago on the show. Like, that's partly why you need a lawyer present, is if they're interviewing you, they already know a lot more than you can possibly imagine about you, you know?
Yeah. And they already have a hypothesis,
right? Yeah. So, and you may not be aware of what that is. But in any case, so yeah, I agree that the trying to decide if someone's lying based upon their body language or their tells or whatever, that nobody does that well. As we said last week, it's 54% at best. It's a coin flip. And having more experience or training or being in a profession that has to do that doesn't help. You have to, so just forget about it. And I think the even deeper skeptical lesson, which I think I would draw, is that people are always looking for a shortcut, right? Mm-hmm. They always want to have some kind of trick. One crazy little trick that you use, and it's the same exact thing comes up in so many different contexts. We've interviewed, for example, an economist on the show a few years ago, who has said the same thing. Like, you could play the stock market based upon a functional analysis, or you could do a content analysis. Right, so you could decide, is this company overvalued? Or you could play astrology with the stock market and decide, look for patterns and try to hack, you know, the stock market and get the shortcut, the cheat. And I think that the whole self-help industry is basically a cheat and a hack and a shortcut on psychology, as opposed to doing all the hard work of actual self-improvement. Like brain games, you're going to get smarter by playing this one simple little game. No, you have to do the hard work of anything that is worthwhile. There is no, you know, shortcut or hack or cheat or magic or whatever. And I think this is just the idea that you're going to find some tell where you could know instantly if someone's lying. Like, that is such, it's so alluring. It's so appealing that people keep looking for that in so many different contexts. And it just, you know, rarely does anything like that ever pan out. It just becomes it's astrology. It just becomes a massive distraction. Just do the hard work.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. A lot of people are always looking for shortcuts. You know, I came up with a really quick and easy way to prevent people from doing that.
That is one simple trick that works all the time.
Life hack.
Yeah. You got me for 3 nanoseconds.
Awesome.
All right, one more email really quick. So this is a follow-up to Kara's piece about sweat and detox.
Ah, yes.
Yeah, so... I'm not going to read any one specific email. We had a bunch of emails, there was a couple of themes, and there was basically questions diving a little bit deeper. So Kara was talking last week about the fact that, you know, a lot of like the infrared saunas or a lot of spa saunas will sell the sauna treatment as a detox treatment. Mm-hmm. And we talked about the fact that that's basically nonsense, that, you know, we don't sweat to detox, we sweat to cool down. You know, our livers and our kidneys do most of the detoxing. And when the spas talk about detox, they're not talking about specific toxins. It's just sort of this vague term that they use as entertainment purposes only, you know, kind of thing. So a number of people asked some version of the question of, but I heard on this other podcast or I read somewhere that, you know, saunas are actually healthy or good for you, or that, you know, there is actual toxins in the sweat. So, yeah, of course, like everything, it's always more complicated. There's always more nuance. It's always deeper. So I did a bit of a deep dive on this just to try to answer a couple of questions. Do we sweat out toxins? And is there any evidence that saunas are good for your health? right?
Just, I think there's a big difference between like, are there metals in our sweat, and is our sweat a mechanism by which we reduce our metals
exactly,
in our body?
Exactly. So there's a tiny amount of heavy metals in our sweat, mercury,
which we mentioned,
lead, cadmium,
on the show.
Which you mentioned.
Yeah.
But is that a meaningful way that the body excretes those things? And so there's not a lot actually of research on this, but I did find one review that found that, you know, it's small, but it's not negligible, meaning that it actually could affect the amount of, say, mercury in your body, the amount that is being lost in sweat. But that's because it's such a tiny amount to begin with, that even if there's orders of magnitude, of course, like more sodium in your sweat than there it would be of any of these heavy metals. But here's the thing. Another doctor writing about this topic pointed out that, let's say you go into a sauna, you sweat off, you know, a couple liters or whatever, you lose a lot of water through sweat. There's some tiny amount of toxins in the sweat. You might actually end up having a net increase in your ultimate toxins, because if that water had been instead filtered through the kidneys, the kidneys would have done a much better job at detoxifying that water from your plasma, basically, that plasma, than the sweat glands did. And in fact, if the kidneys reduce the amount that they're processing, that they're making urine in order to hold on to water because you're sweating it all out, that actually may have a net negative effect on your detox.
Right. Because again, the function of sweat is not to detoxify. The reason we sweat is to cool us off.
Yeah, that's true. But you know, biology is complicated, and just because something has a primary function doesn't mean it might incidentally have secondary functions. So it might be true that certain things do get excreted through the sweat, and that may be biologically important. But it's not something that you need to maximize by going to a sauna. And saunas certainly don't suck toxins out of the deep fat, you know, as they were claiming.
Well, that's really the point that I'm trying to make, is that if there is metal in your sweat, it's probably very likely that there are other places that there are metals, and that still our liver, our kidneys, these are areas that are better at quote, detoxifying this. And ultimately, if you have high levels of metal, this is something that you need to see a physician about.
Right. Don't go to a sauna. Yeah.
Don't go to the sauna, because that's not going to... It's not going to get you to the place that you need to be.
Right, right. But yes, some of that will come out with the sweat. It may actually be biologically significant, but it's not the primary mechanism. And it's not something that you would manipulate, as you say. Now, let's get to this other question, because you mentioned, Kara, that there is some benefit to saunas, mainly for cardiovascular health. And then and one emailer was like, oh, they listened to, I can't remember the name of the podcast, where somebody quoted these dozens of studies showing how saunas have all huge range of health benefits, which immediately set off my science-based medicine, you know, red flags. So, and I kind of knew what I was going to find. I hate to say that, but I mean, I've done this so many times, you know, I can smell like what the literature is going to be like.
Were they in alternative journals? And,
well, that was one thing. It was some of it was published in the Journal of Alternative Medicine, but even when there were articles published in like Mayo Clinical Proceedings and other, you know, mainstream health journals, here's the bottom line. The level of evidence is two things, right? Jack and shit. No, it's two things. Yeah. It's one is physiological studies. Stuff is happening. Studies. So when you're in the sauna, your heart rate goes up, your blood pressure goes down, and your blood vessels become more pliant, and your left ventricular ejection fraction goes up, and your blood perfusion goes up. But your perfusion actually goes up to the skin and decreases for your organs. That's generally not a good thing.
Interesting.
But that's a short-term effect. And of course, you're getting dehydrated. So a sauna, the thing is, from what I could tell from reading the physiological literature, I don't see how a sauna is any different than taking a diuretic. That will lower your blood pressure too, you know? And if you get dehydrated, that will increase your heart rate too. So all of those effects seem to be generic effects of just dehydration. And the effects are also short-lived. There's also the second kind of evidence is epidemiological, where they look at people who go to saunas and see if they have better health outcomes. And some of them do. But of course, it's very hard to control for confounding factors, because even if you're trying to like control for known ones, because people who go to saunas may do other things. That's not a randomized cohort. There are, you know, almost no controlled trials. They're small. The results are, here's a phrase that always perks me up there, heterogeneous. So when they say when you do a meta-analysis or a systematic review and you say, oh, the randomized trials were small and the results were heterogeneous, that means they're all over the place. And it also, and the other thing is, I did look at that alternative medicine journal summary of the evidence, which is going to be the most favorable, and it was very, the tone was extremely favorable. And then even they can't say that there are proven benefits. It's always just there's a suggestion that there might be benefits, and that we need to actually do clinical trials and test the net, you know, health effects. They basically haven't been done. So I'm very dubious about the benefits of the sauna, like health benefits, hardcore health benefits. Not, yeah, it feels good, it's a good warm down or whatever after exercise. It's maybe good for your, you know, it helps your muscles feel relaxed, whatever. But it's just like saying you're going to reduce your chance of dying of heart disease. It's like, yeah, we don't have the kind of data that we would need to say that with any confidence. The suggestions in the literature are all that preliminary stuff is happening kind of studies, which then require a boatload of speculation. And also, there's definitely risks to going into a sauna. There are case, yeah, reports, at least case reports, people having sudden cardiac death in a sauna because they got dehydrated, or, you know, they stayed in too long, or it was too hot. So it's not risk free, and there's no proven health benefits. The physiological changes are all short term, like, I mean, 30 minutes. That's like the kind of studies that are being done. And it's not one of those things where I'm holding my breath thinking, oh yeah, this is going to be some major health benefit to this. If there is, great. I would, you know, happily report that when the studies get done. But the kind of studies we would need to know if there's actually net health benefits to frequently visiting a sauna have not been done. That's the bottom line.
The studies that I saw were also very specific to specific cardiovascular problems.
Yeah.
Like they might have done a study with a certain number of participants who had this very specific cardiovascular or heart issue, and then they did sauna trials with them. It wasn't like a general protective factors, or just like, mm-hmm, normal people going into the sauna are less likely to have, you know, heart, yeah, problems or whatever.
Yeah, but even still, it's like, yeah, of course stuff's happening. You're sitting in a super hot dry room, sweating a lot. Yeah, your cardiovascular system is going to respond to that situation.
But yeah, I could see certain heart, you know, issues. It may be better, some it may be worse. Yeah. Like it's yeah, not, you know. And again, like, use common sense. If you feel dizzy, if you feel unwell, if something feels wrong, get out.
Get out, yeah. So a lot of the like mainstream medical outlets summarizing the evidence for sauna emphasize that. Like, just be safe. Like, bottom line is, don't overdo it. Don't stay too long. Drink a lot of cool water before and afterwards. You know, you got to replace that fluid that you're losing. Don't overdo it, et cetera. We've talked a few years ago about the sweat lodge thing, where they
go
a sweat lodge part of a spiritual ritual, and people die. They die in those sweat lodges because it's like not good for you. And don't get me started on hot yoga. That stuff is nonsense. All right,
there's a great doc about Bikram yoga on Netflix if you want to watch it. It's all about Bikram, and what does it come down to? Sex.
Yeah,
like they all do.
All right, let's go.
You know,
right.
But Jay, even when it's bad, it's good, right? All right,
like pizza.
Let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items, or facts, two real and one fake. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week. I've been meaning to do this one for a while. I'll probably do it again. I think this is really fun. The etymology of phrases. Phrases we use all the time, but you may have no idea where it came from what it actually means.
Love it.
Okay. You ready to hear three phrases and
sure,
where they came from?
Okay.
All right. Item number one, happy as a clam was originally happy as a clam at high water because that is when clams are safe from predators. Item number two, the term nitty-gritty originally referred to the small debris at the bottom of a slave ship and then came to refer to the slaves themselves before ultimately evolving to mean tiny details. Item number three, the term bury the hatchet derives from Native Americans who would literally bury a hatchet as a symbol of a peace accord. Kara, go first.
Clams, I think they're happy because don't they make pearls? No, wait, those are oysters. At high water, they're safe from predators. Are they really, or are they less safe from predators at high water? I don't want the slave one to be true. And the bury the hatchet one sounds like we always attribute weird things to Native culture that I feel like we didn't do correctly. So I don't know. I have no idea which one. This is a shot in the dark, but I'm going to say it's the hatchet one is the fiction.
Okay, Jay.
All right. Happy as a clam. You know, the first thing that popped into my mind was that, you know, clams almost in a weird kind of way, you could think that they're smiling or whatever, right? But I'm fairly sure that that's not the reason why. There's something about that one that rings in my head. So I'm going to say that one is science. The second one, the nitty gritty. Yeah, I mean, you know, nits and grit, right? And then they're saying that this is, so what would nits or bugs? I don't know. That's interesting. And then Kara doesn't like bury the hatchet. And I just don't see, okay, this is why I think that Kara is correct. I don't think that Native Americans would bury a useful tool or a metal that they have. They have metal. Where are they getting the metal from anyway? I mean, I wonder, you know, with the hatchet, they could have been stone tools. Sure. I don't think they'd bury tools like that. I don't think so. I think that was a fiction.
Okay, Bob.
Let's see, happy as a clam. I've always heard happy as a clam at high tide, but high water, same thing. I'm sure you wouldn't just change one stupid word like that.
Yeah, that's what that means. Same thing.
Okay.
That's not the gotcha.
But then I was thinking the gotcha might be that when clams are safe, are they safe? And I was trying to think, like, they would be safe from terrestrial predators. So maybe that does make sense. Nitty gritty, you've got no idea. I mean, no idea at all. But bury the hatchet. Yeah, that one strikes me as potentially problematic as well. So I'll go with the guys, say that's fiction.
Okay, and Evan.
Happy as a clam. Okay. Safe from predators. Did people consider themselves predators? I mean, you have to think about this. If you're going to say happy as a clam, obviously it's a very human-centric thing. You're not thinking of other animals in the context other than the clam itself, because that is when clams are safe from predators. So unless you're considering a person themselves a predator.
I was a person, not a predator.
Well, I get that, but you see, but a human came up with it, and did they consider themselves the predator in this context? Hmm. So this one's a little, I'm unsure about this one. Let's just put it that way. The nitty gritty one, never heard this before. No idea. And it's, you know, a bit disturbing if you ask me. And that gives it some ring of authenticity.
Right.
I think the bury the hatchet one, I'm going to break from the group and say that one is true. I do seem to have a recollection of learning this way back when, that this was in fact a symbol of peace and they would do that. There were several symbolic things that Native Americans did, and I believe this was one of them. The clam one, I don't understand, you know, that one is just something not quite right for me about that one, so I'll say that one's the fiction.
You're not happy with the clam?
No, I'm not happy with the happy as a clam description.
All right, so you all agree on number two, so we'll start there. The term nitty-gritty originally referred to the small debris at the bottom of a slave ship and then came to refer to the slaves themselves before ultimately evolving to mean tiny details. You guys all think that one is real, and this one is the fiction.
Oh, thank goodness. Sorry, oh, good.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so
well, I'd never heard that before.
That is, however, a myth about the origin of the phrase nitty gritty, but it's not true. There's absolutely no reference to support it whatsoever.
So does it have anything to do with bugs?
So we don't know.
Oh, shit.
We don't know what the origin of nitty gritty is. We know what the first, you know, recorded use of it is that you can find. It's actually fairly recent. It's an early 20th century really saying, and you know, it's one of those. There's a lot of phrases that have repeat a rhyming word, you know, like nitty gritty.
Yeah.
And so those tend to catch on just because they're like of the poetry of it. But yeah, it just means, you know, it means the tiny little details. It's always meant that. It never really meant anything else. There are references going back to 1956, you know, that kind of thing. So it's actually more recent than you might think. So one here, so 1956, for example, this line from Alice Childress's novel, Like One of the Family, you'll find nobody comes down to the nitty-gritty when it calls for naming things for what they are. That's one of the earliest references to it. Another one, 1937, there's a song titled That Nitty-Gritty Dance. So that's it. Those are the earliest references. Not really sure exactly what the ultimate origin of it was, but then the stuff about the slave ships was just made up. That there's no evidence that that's correct.
But it sounds kind of like it makes, I mean, I don't know, it computes the idea of it being nits and grit, like small things.
Yeah, so
like debris and grit.
Little tiny things.
Yeah, little tiny things. But and again, just that rhyming thing. But and some of the references I was reading were saying that, you know, there's a lot of paranoia about phrases being racist. And so people almost like look for a connection sometimes, even when there isn't one. You know what I mean? So that might be why that myth sort of came about. But let's go back to number one. Happy as a clam was originally happy as a clam at high water because that is when clams are safe from predators. That is true. That is science. You know, whether or not it's literally true that clams are safe at high water is beside the point. That was the meaning of the phrase. It's very common for phrases to be shortened over time, right? You guys know the rest of, like, the one that irritates me is when people say the proof is in the pudding.
Yes. The tasting, yes.
The proof of the pudding is in the tasting.
Oh, weird.
Yeah, so, but people there's a tendency to shorten phrases over time just for efficiency. You know, you don't want to say a long sentence. But then the meaning gets bastardized and then misunderstood, and then it could morph into something else. It's very common that they take the opposite meaning of what they originally meant.
How about ironclad?
Yeah.
Ironclad and copper bottomed.
And copper bottomed, right. But then got rid of that part. That's right.
That was great, Evan.
So the happy as a clam goes back to the early 1800s. So there's a reference from 1833 in the Harpy's Head, Kentucky. It never occurred to him to be discontented. He was happy as a clam at high tide, at high water. Yeah, so that goes back a while. But probably originated in New England, where there's a lot of clamming going on. Yep. Phrase. All right, go on. Number three, the term bury the hatchet derives from Native Americans who would literally bury a hatchet as a symbol of a peace accord. That is true. That is science. I loved that one because it sounds so fake.
Yeah.
It does. I agree. It sounds so much like something was made up, right? Because you would think, oh, it's got to have some more nuanced meaning. But no, they've done that for centuries. And there are lots of examples going back to that we know of, going back to the 1600s, even the 17th century. And it was very ritualized. You know, they had a hatchet that had all, like, it was very ornate, and they would bury it for like big, like when multiple tribes have an accord and unite. So there's many examples of this in history of Native American tribes doing this ritual, you know, literally burying a hatchet. And that's where the phrase came from. It's interesting. See, it's one of those things that sounds fake when you first hear it. It sounds like something made up, but it's true.
Well, it looks like you made out nice this week, Steve.
Again.
Yeah.
Are you getting tired of sweeping us? Because
not even close.
I'm feeling a little tired on this end.
You guys still have more sweeps against me than I have against you this year.
Is that right?
Yeah.
But it's interesting that there's been a lot of sweeps in both directions so far. You know, it's interesting. I think it's just nothing. I think it's just randomness is clumpy. Right. And this was, as Kara said, this is pretty much a crapshoot unless you actually heard one of these, you know.
You know, now all week, all I got to hear from Steve is, I want science fiction. I swept you guys, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, because I always do that. Yeah.
Steve, the great gloater. Yeah.
The great gloater. That's what you'll be remembered by.
Yeah. All right, Evan, give us a quote.
Nothing in life is to be feared. It is only to be understood. Now is the time to understand more so that we may fear less. Marie Curie.
Wow, I like it.
That's great. It's a very good quote.
I like it, but doesn't that strike you as a little ironic?
Yes, it does.
I mean, maybe we should fear certain things like, radioactivity, or at least respect it, you know? So I mean, obviously, you know, we know Marie Curie died of the radioactivity from mm-hmm. the substances that she was researching, that was, she was trying to understand. And I get what she's saying, but, you know, there's a balance in there where you respect the power of the things that you're studying too, you know.
When did she say it? Was it early or late in her life?
See.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, because early on she had no idea, but by the time her husband died of, well, actually he got hit by a car, but he was suffering with, or a car, or, carriage, yeah, whatever they were back then. He was suffering with the effects of radiation poisoning when he died. She may have changed her attune.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'd like to modify my earlier statement.
Yeah, it took years for them to start seeing the effects. Because remember, for like years, people were going and getting radiation baths.
They were drinking radiation.
They were drinking it. They were putting it in on their face. They were bathing in it for its health, you know, purposes.
And that only ended. That only ended when the FDA banned it. That's what it took. Like in the 40s, like 1947 or something. But I would say that the sentiment there is that we shouldn't fear the unknown. We should study it and try to understand it. I think that's a good, that's the good, you know, way to frame that. But again, just historically, there's a little irony in there. Okay, well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Sure, man. Thanks, Steve.
Got it, Steve.
Thank you.
We will see you, most of us will see you at the Friday live stream. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.